curious when I was a child was a permanent state of mind. Politics, culture, we have the duty to understand more or less in order to survive in society and above all in order to change the society. Conscientization implies that we begin to establish relationships between facts. We teach them how to read texts, but we never teach them how to read contexts. It's impossible, as I always say, to read words without reading the world.
In 1990, Dr. Carlos Torres, associate professor at the Graduate School of Education at UCLA, traveled to Sao Paulo, Brazil, to interview that country's most famous educator, Dr. Paulo Freire. They spoke about Dr. Freire's youth, the experiences that led him into teaching. They spoke about the link between political consciousness and learning, which underlies Paulo Freire's revolutionary educational theories. They spoke of Dr. Freire's unique approach to the problem of illiteracy, teacher and student learning together how to read the world, and thus the word. Paulo Freire was born in Recife, Brazil in 1921 in the book Literacy, Reading the Word and the World, co-authored with Donaldo Macedo. Dr. Freire wrote, "I learned to read and write on the ground of the backyard of my house, in the shade of the mango trees, with words from my world rather than from the wider world of my parents. The earth was my blackboard, the sticks my chalk."
Let's start by asking Professor Paulo Freire about his past. How did you become involved with the field of education? When and how did you start to live and write Pedagogy of the Oppressed?
For me, being curious when I was a child was a permanent state of mind. Sometimes when I think of that, I try to remember, I have the impression that it was the totality of my body which was curious. I was always asking questions to myself, and not exclusively to my parents, for example, but to myself. I also loved going beyond the questions, that is, the answers, and reformulating the questions, starting from the answers I was receiving. I also remember how much I loved to risk. Not, of course, to risk, for example, very dangerous risks, but to do something which I call today a certain kind of intellectual adventure. That is, I was not afraid. When I was adolescent, I remember the times in which I used to allow my imagination to fly. And generally my imagination went very far away, but always in my imagination, flying, I was a teacher. I had dreams of becoming a teacher. I used to play as a teacher. That is, I loved to do that. And this is what I still love today. That is, I continue to be a teacher. I need to help my mother. My father had died when I was 13 years old, and we still had lots of difficulties to survive. And I used to study very seriously the Portuguese syntax. And I knew very well, I had a very good command on our language. And then I started teaching privately to get some money. You know? And sometimes I used to teach my own colleagues, you know, who were not good students of Portuguese. You know? And the more I had the experience of teaching young people like me, the more I became convinced that I really was being a teacher or becoming a teacher, something which I loved. And when I was 22 years, I met my first wife, who you knew also and met, Elsa. Elsa was a very good educator. She was a great teacher of preschool. You know, she knew how to deal with the kids and how to make them writing and the reading, you know, the words. I met her teaching her. You know, she was preparing herself for a seminar, something like this. And then she came to me for me to give some syntax classes to her. And because of that, today I have 80 grandchildren. Because of the syntax of Portuguese language, I am grandfather. But when I was a child, I had met the kids of the peasants, of the workers, with whom I used to play. And I started learning lots of things about poverty when I was a child. And when I was 25 years old, 26 years old, as a teacher, I was invited to work for another institution through which I could meet workers. And it was a fantastic moment of my life. Maybe I can say today that the years I spent working every day with peasants, with workers in Pernambuco, my state, the years I spent with them committing mistakes, speaking to them in a wrong way, but learning how to do better, were fundamental years for the development of some of my ideas today.
After receiving his doctorate from the University of Recife in 1959, Paulo Freire participated in campaigns against illiteracy throughout northeast Brazil. When the military seized power in Brazil in 1964, Dr. Freire was imprisoned and then exiled to Chile, where he witnessed the late 60s mobilization of peasants and workers. His experiences gave rise to his classic book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Later, his work would influence literacy campaigns throughout the world.
Let me now ask you about a word that you have used for more than 30 years already, and you stopped using it a few years ago, the notion of conscientization, that very difficult neologism in English, which some people have translated as critical consciousness or awareness. What does it mean for you, the notion of conscientization?
The French prise de conscience, to take consciousness of, is a normal way of being a human being. Conscientization is something which goes beyond the prise de conscience. It's something which is starting from the ability of getting, of taking the prise de conscience, is something which implies to analyze. It is a kind of reading the world rigorously, or almost rigorously. It's the way of reading how society works. It's the way to understand how to get power, what means not to have power. Finally, conscientizing implies a deepened reading of reality. In other words, conscientization implies that we begin to establish relationships between facts. For example, if I speak about Pinochet in Latin America, I know that I am not just speaking about Pinochet as an individual from Chile, but I am speaking about lack of respect from the power, the foreign power concerning us in Latin America. That is, I understand the relationships between imperialism and dominated nations. Pinochet is not only himself. That is, this possibility of establishing relationships between the facts, the events in society, is one of the goals for a conscientizing process. And because of that, conscientization does not mean, or is never a kind of aspirin which we give, we prescribe for the oppressed people. That is, if it is as if, for example, I could sell 20 pills for the oppressed and 25 for the oppressors, pills of conscientization, and then they get better tomorrow. No, it's not like, it's not a medicine. It's an exercise of understanding much more rigorously how society works. For example, let us suppose that I show a group of illiterate a picture of some area of São Paulo, no? In which we have poverty, and sometimes misery. It is a piece of the big city, of the reality in which the illiterates live. I am trying to challenge them to see the concreteness through the picture of a piece of the totality. This is an exercise for knowing. We always have to do that. You know? We have to split the totality which we are trying to know. In some moment, we have to re-totalize the totality which we split in order to know it.
How could you link literacy training, which is for some people conceived as merely teaching how to read, write, and do basic numeracy, with the notion of conscientization, or the project of conscientization?
Yeah, I think that one of the tasks we have as teachers, as educators, is the following. If really education is also, and not exclusively, a certain theory of knowledge being put into practice. It means that it's impossible to think of education without thinking of knowing. Of knowing and not of transferring knowledge. For me, in the first moment of adult literacy, from the point of view of a theory of knowledge, the big preoccupation of the teachers should form, not train, should help the educators to, on the one hand, to understand the reasons why it's necessary to get distance from the object. On the other hand, to learn how to approach the object in getting distance from it. Do you see? Because dialectically, the only way you have to approach is to get distance. Without that, it's difficult to understand the things. And for me, conscientization is this.
Asked what he would have to say to the 1990 Literacy Conference in Edmonton, Dr. Freire had two comments.
First of all, that teaching someone how to read and to write words is something serious, very serious, which implies or demands from those who teach a strong respect for those who are being taught. What do I mean by respect for those who are being taught or will be taught? I mean the respect for the knowledge based, of course, in a common sense, which the illiterate bring with them to the school, to the classes. Respect for the knowledge they already have and the respect for their language, which is culture, for their identity. In my words for those who will be together in this meeting, is that they become prepared, well formed, competent to teach. But they never forget they are involved in a political process. It's not just a game, and it is not also a question of making a favor to the illiterates, but it's a kind of engagement.
In spite of misunderstandings of his work and criticisms of his theories, Dr. Freire continues to argue that linking conscientization with literacy training implies an educational process that is directive. His concern is that this directive education must remain democratic.
The point is to understand what are the possibilities of distortion the directiveness can suffer, can be exposed to. The first one is the manipulation, is the directiveness to become manipulative. Then it is the way how the authoritarian teachers deal with their practice, educational practice. That is, the directiveness of education into the hands of the authoritarian people, educators, becomes necessarily manipulation. The other risk, or the other possibility, is for the directiveness of education to become into the hands of the expontaneists. The expontaneism is license. That is, you do what you want to do and not what you can do. the lack of limits. The lack of limits, which does not help freedom to become freedom, and distorts authority, without which freedom also cannot be constituted, is the second risk we have when we don't understand and we don't live, we don't experience the directiveness of education.
What about the hidden curriculum? What about the social relationships established at the level of the classroom? What about the values promoted in the sometimes unspoken relationship between teacher and student?
In asking this question, Dr. Torres went directly to one of Paulo Freire's key concepts in Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the fact that an oppressive ideology can be so ingrained in a person that it forms a psychological obstacle to liberation, or in the case of a teacher, the ability to learn with students while teaching.
In your words, and I think that right now I go to the main question of your question, which is the hidden curriculum. That is, let us suppose that I am more or less theoretically clear concerning what I should do in my relationships with the students, but the power of the authoritarian ideology which I keep inside of me is so strong, I am in such a way dependent on it, historically, socially, and individually, that even though theoretically I would like to be and to proclaim the excellence of democracy, in practice, I am an authoritarian teacher. Then, in being an authoritarian teacher, what I am doing is to explicit the hidden curriculum, which has to do with the ideology I keep inside of myself. Because of that, Carlos, I think that one of the most important tasks we could have in the permanent formation, I don't like the English word training, but in the permanent process of forming the educators, is to invite them to think critically about what they do, about their practice. And it means to invite us also to think about what we are doing. That is, to make self-criticism. Then I think that the most deep aspects of this hidden curriculum is in the very historical and social experience of society and of the teacher. And if the teacher, the democratic teacher, is not able to become more and more critical of his past or her past, historical past and social conditions, in order to be consistent with his or her dreams, the hidden curriculum will become more and more full of ideological
underpinnings.
Yes. I had to talk about something like this, the relationships between educators and educatees, in a very special case with the educator, and she, in some moment, she became angry, you know, and she said to me, yes, I am authoritarian, and I will continue to be. I said to her, look, I know that you are authoritarian, but I would like to ask you very lovingly to begin to be less authoritarian in this administration. But really, I cannot impose on you the taste of democracy.
Some people have complained to me sometimes that Paulo Freire is such a gifted teacher, such a brilliant facilitator. He's asking all those who have embraced the profession of teacher, not necessarily the vocation of teacher, to be like him, to have the same confidence in becoming, to have the same thirst for knowledge, to be as competent politically as he is, to be as competent technically as he is. What would you say to those who will complain, those kind of teachers are not there, so we better work with what we have at hand?
Really, it's not easy to have this kind of teacher. No? But I think that I could begin to ask this question, which I also ask myself, with another question. Is it easy to train good, really social scientists, good physicists, competent people, serious people, honest people, dedicated people, loving people? Is it easy? No, I think that everything is difficult to be done. The question for me is whether it's possible or not, whether it is an impossible dream or if it is a possible dream. For me, first of all, it's a possible dream. Secondly, when you know that some kind of dream is a possible one, you have another question. Is it possible for today or for tomorrow?
For Paulo Freire, the work of teaching is a constant reevaluation of theory in the light of practice, an evolution that never stops, that never regards itself as complete.
The question for me is that in a society of practice, we have a hidden theory. The point for me is how to unveil the practice and its moments in order to get into the hands the unknown theory, the not yet perceived theory. And I even would say the point is how to discover in the practice the not yet knowledge, which is a theoretical task to discover and to invent. Then, the more I think critically, rigorously about what I do and about what has been done by others, the more I have possibility first to understand the raison d'être for the very practice, and secondly, because of that, I become able to have a better practice next time. Sometimes what is bad among us, the so-called academic people, is